Hey, this is Hamilton Lighthouser from The Walkman. You're listening to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida.
Nothing I've been asking for a loan, a small loan. She told me that I was not economically viable. And I thanked him for 7 years. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. How'd your loan ever go? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like.
Yes, everybody wants to rule the world. Welcome to Punkonomics. My name is Jesse Velez, and today we have a special guest, Corey Carl, and of course, the host of our show, Dr. Benny Balick. Yes, today we're going to be talking about, the mic's wearing on, so another surprise here at WPRK. Anyway, let me reintroduce our guest, Corey Carl.
Good to be here.
And our resident host and mentor and genius behind Punkonomics, the guru, yes, the Buddha, Dr. Benny Balick.
Morning.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to be talking about the fiscal cliff, and hopefully we can find some parishes to go down with it. So, Corey, let's start off with the theme today.
We're going to start off, we're going to talk about aggregate demand, which is, it sounds like a very abstract and complicated and boring concept, but it's quite relevant to everybody who's listening. It's not that complicated. Still might be boring now that I think about it. Aggregate demand in economics, it's defined as the total demand for final goods and services in the economy. And to simplify that even further for our listeners, if you could just imagine yourself, all of the purchases you make throughout the course of a year, and then if you were to add that to all the purchases everybody else in the country or in any particular country makes over the course of the year, that's aggregate demand.
Or foreigners buying stuff America, if we're talking about the American aggregate demand.
Right.
Everything.
So there's an economist, Paul Krugman. Some people might be familiar with him. He's probably out at the forefront of the aggregate demand issue.
Isn't that your favorite?
No, I think he's doing a good job, actually. It's a bit inspiring to us because he's an academic, very well-established academic, mainstream. I know people think he's a flaming liberal, but we've already discussed about the strangeness of the political spectrum.
I just want to pull you there.
No, he's a good guy. He is a good guy.
Like
he's a good
like
mainstream economic, kind of the voice of reason. Nothing too radical, but a good voice of reason in the New York Times, which is basically...
I like him better than Peter Morici.
Who is that even?
Oh, he's another economist that does some...
You got both of us on that one.
He's pretty much on the right of things.
I can't listen to mainstream media, whether it's MSNBC, Fox, whatever. I need it unfiltered. I can't take it, you know? I need it filtered through like the Comedy Channel or South Park.
I tend to keep a close watch on them because they are the true enemy. They're the ones manipulating everything to their own gains and not for everybody else. So I turn it on once in a while, especially if I want to get agitated and, you know.
I can work on that ulcer, you know.
As a note, a lot of people that are in the mainstream media that are so-called economists, they're really just pundits at this point. They have no background in academia. They don't publish in peer-reviewed journals.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's like people don't realize. You never see economists, not even right-wing economists. Some ways, they are even more dangerous if serious right-wingers will explain to people that this is not capitalism, this is not conservatism, this is, you're being played.
Right, exactly.
They would have even more gravitas than some crazy guy.
Some of these guys, their only credential is that they work for a think tank, like, you know, the Peterson Institute comes to mind. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, they might have an undergraduate's degree in economics, maybe they pursued a PhD, but they don't publish in peer review. And most of academia, they would look at them and just, these guys are way off the charts. You know, Steve Hanke's one guy that comes to mind. I mean, I was listening to him the other day, and he's like, well, you don't need taxes. You should just have toll roads and, you know, everything should be run by private enterprise.
Right. It would be funny if it was a comedy show.
Right.
It's just that it's our futures.
You know, now that you bring up toll roads, it's kind of funny how every other country's economics, or I shouldn't say economics, the way government deals with their population and their wealth is that I was in Tokyo one time, and a friend of mine came pick me up at the airport. And he says, it's going to be about an hour or so by the time we get to downtown Tokyo. I said, okay, cool. So we're driving along, and here we are on the toll roads, right, which what we call toll roads are most of the time freeways. And I said, so these are the freeways, this is the toll roads. And he says, well, in Japan, we call them freeways, but the prime minister says that the freeways are not free. So by the time we got to Tokyo, he already had spent about $100 and something. Mm. So just to give our folks out there a little perspective on, you know, it's not always greener, you know, on the other side of the fence. Needless to say, everybody thinks that Tokyo is expensive, and it is, but it's just a matter of economics, just like here.
It might not be a bad idea to cost a road, and then you have, you know, a lot of people go to Europe and are impressed by the highway system. It's also expensive.
Sure.
Well, I mean, and like in England, I know they were kind of the leaders of this. They do congestion charging.
Right.
So the tolls are different places, different times of the days, and that's to try to control traffic flows. And my opinion is actually very forward thinking.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah, just a protocol. If you want to ride alone into town and congestion, then you pay an extra fee for it.
That's right.
Of course, they also have public transportation.
Right.
You know, so there's an alternative.
Things, right?
There's an
here
alternative.
We don't have roads. We don't have very few toll roads, but the roads look like, you know, third world. Yeah. You need an SUV in America. It's not about, you know, you can't ride a regular car because the potholes are too bad. You have to, you know, you negotiate hard terrain.
We're in Florida. I mean, the roads are really nice here. I'm from up north. I mean, you go to Michigan or someplace like that. I mean, now you're talking about really bad roads.
The Winter Park is the joke, I gotta say. I mean, you know, we here take some self-criticism, people,
right,
you know.
Right. And
the whole cobblestone thing, it reminds me of a scene in Monty Python The Quest for the Holy Grail, where the castles in Wales, and they keep building a castle on the swamp, and it sinks into the swamp. They build it again, they sink into the swamp. It's nice to know where my... where would, you know, real estate taxes go? But let's rustle ourselves back into
that was quite a tangent. So back, Paul Krugman, one of the things he always comes back to is the paradox of thrift. And the paradox of thrift is, it's essentially your choice to not spend money, your choice to save money, if you will.
Okay.
That is basically the opportunity for someone else's income, right? So if you, you know, something simple like a hot dog vendor, right? If you don't spend a dollar on that hot dog and you save it instead, that's a dollar of income that the hot dog vendor doesn't have, and therefore that hot dog vendor doesn't have to spend on further goods and services. And it really, it comes down to how money circulates through the economy. If everybody is trying to save at the same time, economic activity just tanks. And that's all there is to it. There's really no way around it.
That's a little bit what's going on right now. I mean, it's a core, it's an inconsistency, right? I mean, because what I think is important is for every individual that's saving, that's not buying the hot dog or that latest gadget or whatever it is, right? It's rational for them. So a lot of people, Americans aren't shopping. as much as they used to. Because they are smart, and they know that their chances of losing their job in the next year are pretty high.
Right.
So they're afraid, they're hoarding their money. Of course, like Corey was saying, the fact that a lot of people perceive the world like that, all the poor, obviously, and that have nothing to spend, the middle class who are holding on to what little's left, etc., all the 99% is not spending. And therefore, that denies all that money from circulating in the economy. And that's why the job creators don't create jobs, because they will start manufacturing if they believe they can sell the stuff.
That's right.
That's also underlying the issue that it is complete and utter bunk stupidity. You're being paid. You're a traitor, if you ask me, to talk about job creator, trickle down, cutting taxes to the wealthy. I mean, you can be a right-on right-winger. If you're honest, you know that might apply in a booming economy. If you're an arch-conservative, then in the late 90s, you would say, all right, let's cut more taxes. Well, actually, Clinton cut. Well, never mind.
Okay.
But saying it now...
Yeah.
There's nothing to it. There's absolutely no theoretical way how that would stimulate the economy. This whole... I have to say it. I mean, I challenge anybody to come up with anything rational, or just to send us a link to anybody who is not either corrupt or an idiot talking about reducing taxes to the wealthy right now. Right.
As a note to our listeners, one thing you have to keep in mind is that money isn't what... affects your quality of life, right? I mean, in the real world, yeah, money does. But commerce is what affects your quality of life. The exchange of goods and services, that's what actually allows you to live a higher standard of living than cavemen, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
Than our ancestors. So, you know, the argument put forth by the Austrians, right, that economic growth comes from savings, okay, that's savings in the real world, and you know that comes in the form of, you know, building factories, educating individuals, right?
Yeah, because saving and investing not spending it on luxuries, but taking that saving and reinvesting it into the economy.
The savings are real things, but for some reason the Austrians then take that and they take that to the monetary economy. They attribute saving money to savings and investment into right. real goods, into real things that are actually going to improve your quality of life. That's not the way it works. It's where the Keynesians really...
Just follow my train of thought here, but you know, the one thing that keeps sticking out in our conversations about economics is, and I'm looking at it from, as an American, what would be good for us. What stands out is that every time we talk about a different country, they have a totally different value system, you know, as far as the traditional family saves, you know, they pretty much work together instead of, you know, apart as individuals like we do here. We're pretty much an individualist society. And, you know, when you're saying about supply and demand, well, here's the thing. If there are no jobs... obviously, there are no people to buy the goods.
Right.
Okay. Now, to be able to curtail that pattern, you would have to get rid of greed, literally. And we live in a society where everybody here is pretty much programmed to be greedy as a form of survival, not because they're being bad, but as a form of survival. Now, how do you change that?
You don't.
So... basically, are we doomed here as a culture because of the way we are programmed to live? I mean, I know I'm getting philosophical.
It's certainly not something you throw a switch on. You know, it's a basic animalistic instinct, if you will. Right. I mean, and there's been a lot of work in anthropology.
There's a lot of cooperation in nature. I'd say that maybe a little bit. You have to adjust the economic system. It's more fundamental in a sense. This culture of greed and radical individualism. First of all, other countries are following suit right behind America, including Western Europe, etc. So
sure,
it's
because
not
they,
like
they,
so
they, they've been trying to emulate us, just like the Japanese with the cigarettes.
Well, it's not a conscious choice. I think it's the nature of the beast. You see, indeed, our families have been fractured by in many ways by, for example, not valuing care work. So, you know, we had a show about women's rights a few weeks ago. So maybe half, at least a third of the economic valuable economic activity is unpaid in our
these
world.
Are market,
like child,
market, it's market failure.
It's a form of market failure. So we're not valuing the fact that a woman takes care of kids. You know, where we tell her, yeah, go to work 3 weeks after you have a baby. The hell with you. Back on the grind. So the benefit that society will gain through stable families, support system and networks, people helping each other, solidarity, are not counted, not valued. In fact, they're disvalued. And I would say there's room for conspiracy, only true conspiracy.
Sure, of course.
In the sense that is good. This fragmentation is good for some businesses, these parasitic businesses, non-innovative businesses that are feeding upon the people, like healthcare, for example. Get them sick. Get them neurotic.
Keep them
sick. Pump them up with drugs. You know, unnecessary. I mean, that's kind of what maintains a lot of these unproductive parts of our economy. So I'm saying that the crazy lonely kids, our divorce rates, are based on this allowing ourselves to be alone, no support, networks. So it would require a more general change, but definitely I would argue, and we cannot, that it's definitely not the human conditions. Even apes show themselves to be attached significantly to fairness and cooperation.
Right.
Because the history of mankind is successful cooperation. We are taught, by the way, in America, that's a big lesson. I teach history, I get into hot water about this. The history of why is America great, you know? That question, right?
It's not a big question, right?
That amazing person.
No.
Did it. That no, it's people getting together and it's
right.
Hard and they're arguing and they hate each other, but that's the human success throughout history.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, just to back you up on that, in psychology, I mean, just a simple experiment like with ducks, okay? If you get them from the moment they're babies, okay, and you show them a pattern that imprints their auto until they die. I mean, that's been proven time and after again. Not that we have the mentality of ducks, but human nature also tends to be imprinted.
There's a psychologist at Yale who recently came out with a book. I just read it. Paul Bloom. I don't have to look it up. And he's actually running some very interesting experiments with babies. To see just...
sounds unethical, but I'm willing to listen.
No,
Lovecraft.
60 Minutes actually recently had a segment.
Zimbaldo.
So you can see, and he actually shows, you know, how he does some of the experiments. It's really pretty novel the way he does them. And you would be shocked, actually, to see just how selfish babies are, though, at a young age. Certain tendencies that babies have, and we're talking about like 6 months old, way too early.
But that goes back to Darwinism, I mean, survival of the fittest. I mean,
right.
But...
Very complicated
all,
term.
All things being equal in the control situation like where we live in, you can still pretty much change the culture to go by a certain amount of rules. I mean, a prime example, the reason we were getting so much flack from the Japanese during World War II wasn't because, all these other mindless explanations. The fact is, they're a collective society. They basically work for everybody. You know, it's not just mom and dad. They work together as a cohesive group. We don't.
They have to because they're so densely packed together. You know, if they weren't, they would have been extinct a long time
ago. Right, they would have been cannibals, right? That's another experiment that
if we're going philosophical,
sure.
it's a big issue here. It's generally a Jean-Jacques Rousseau way of looking at people and Francis Bacon way of looking at people. Are they born good and then corrupted by society, or are they born evil and then, you know,
right,
improved by society? And like most things, it's probably a little bit of both. But it's kind of a co-evolution, we should call it. It's kind of one affects the other. Our system is reinforcing individual behavior.
Yeah.
But it's about balance a little bit, to go even earlier in philosophy, back to good old Aristotle, right? Balance. So I should think that we clearly can show that in America today, people are indeed too individualistic. And then, you know, we are told that this one nasty guy somewhere in some foreign country is the source of our problem. If we only kill him, our problem will go away. And right. they don't. Or then we're told this guy, he's our savior. If you just vote for him, our problems will go away. And they don't. So this is in anthropology and sociology, they call it, you know, individual versus structural thinking. Nah, it's in the connections. It's in the connections.
Right.
Perhaps actually that's interesting because you were just saying that talk about a good right winger, a good Austrian economist that you read the last Nassim Taleb book. I think there is an example of an Austrian who pays attention. He's certainly no fool and a very interesting guy. So Austrian is right wing in economics, very right, very conservative. But he talks about structuralism a lot.
Taleb, it's kind of ironic. He criticizes economists to no end, and then he aligns himself with the Austrians. He's got a
very famous book called The Black Swan.
Right.
He's a finance guy with experience in finance, and just should put up a link.
I'll
put up a link for that. He's not an official plot.
I just read the book.
It's a good book.
It is. It's good.
Yeah, we can't tell people to go buy it. We can just say that we read it and we found it very interesting.
I did find the magic button here that says dump. There you go. Anyway, no plugs went out.
Not a plug. All right. It's a very interesting book. It takes a look at modern society, its complexities and its interdependencies, and you know where there are some potentially serious failings, and he discusses how we should deal with these going forward. He talks about trying to learn a lot from nature and the way nature organizes itself. And then applying that to general. It's way too much to put on to a radio show.
It sounds very interesting. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
People interested in finance, not the nitty-gritty of how to invest, but the nature of the financial animal.
Yeah, well, and he's expanded outside of finance in this particular book, you know, to other areas that are affected by finance but are non-financial, such as, you know, healthcare. It's...
The thing is that, like many decent scholars and
he's a good writer too, by the way.
He is. He's fun to read.
He's a good. I mean, unlike most people who work in this domain, he's actually very lucid and entertaining.
And he's well generally educated. You can just tell. I'll give a bias. You know, we're in a liberal arts college. I mean, the non-specialization. You just tell. I'm sorry, but if you are, you know, you to be an educated person, you have to read a few books, and not only in your field. You know, seen a few plays, seen a few movies, thought about a few things. I mean, that's kind of the idea of general education. And quite frankly, there's a plug that I'm sure I can make. You know, people don't realize you're like South Park. You don't think of that as high culture typically. But if you are well educated, you watch South Park and you see the references they make. These kids, seen the classics, they've read the classics, all of those. So if you're not well educated, it's not, you're not as good as me. You're just missing some jokes.
You know, and curiously enough,
that's right.
Curiously enough, this goes back to our class, you know, economics and propaganda, which I definitely enjoy. I wish you had a part two to your course.
We're doing it every semester, but hey, too late.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to the dean about that and get you a part two. But you know, going back to that, I mean, that you know, a lot of the things that you've told us in class, where basically we are being controlled, you know, literally, and we don't know it. They make us believe that we are individuals, but we're really not. We're kind of like Star Trek, the new generation, when the captain gets sucked up by like a colony. I can't remember. The Borg. That's what we are. We're pretty much
Borg,
except that we're made to believe that we're individuals.
The Borg are effective. The Borg are you know, they're drones, you know, but their society is flourishing.
Oh yeah, right.
You know,
that's true.
We're the Borg when we short circuited and are stabbing each other in the back. You know, running around. We're not functioning.
We're the Borg that was programmed by Microsoft.
Exactly. But getting back to the Fistel Cliff Quarry, and there's the burning question that most laymen like myself. Is it something that I need to worry? Is it something that I need to
100%.
You know, save some money to get that plane ticket to get, you know, out of here?
Well,
are we going to go into an anarchy type situation, or is it something that, you know, everybody should be conscious about and start working towards getting it fixed?
Isn't the end of the world due like next week or something?
I think it was last night.
Oh.
I think.
Oh, well.
Don't know.
No, I'm not worried about that. You know, I mean,
yeah, I've never, to be quite honest, I've always thought this.
Not last night.
I've always maintained that my life here has been a dream. So I mean, if it ends, it stops, or whatever, I'm still enjoying.
Just as a quick side note to the whole end of the world thing, the people who programmed the Unix system, the Unix operating system, their calendar ended in 2038. So the Mayans did pretty well to get us all the way to 2012 with their calendar. But no. Should you be worried and get a plane ticket to get out of the United States? No, I don't. I mean, first of all, where are you going to go? Because if you look at Europe, if you want to see what the U.S. would look like in terms of its economy, if we were to, you know, just go over the fiscal cliff, look at maybe not Greece, but look at Spain or, you know, France doesn't look so great right now, or England.
No, nowhere. Yeah, and Western Europe is not looking good.
I mean, Germany is struggling. Germany is the one that's, you know, really benefited from the European Monetary Union and the European Union in general. But
but it's all gone to their banksters too. Bottom line, it's not so much about countries; it's about class. So you know, the banksters in Greece are doing great. You know, their buddies, the German banksters, they are both feeding off the labor of. The unemployed Spanish today, the bankrupt Greek. There's been a massive move between classes, from a little like America, you know, the poor, the middle class, funding the very wealthy. In Europe also, the disease is global. In fact, I probably repeat myself, but that's one of those things that bear repeating. There's this fundamental imbalance in this notion of a global economy, which is overwhelmingly flowing between rich countries, by the way, or rich sectors in poor countries like China. People forget 800 million people are eating beep there for the past 10 to 15 years. It's 200 million are living on the coast and benefiting at least to some unequal sense. So there's a lot of trouble there too. There's trouble everywhere. And the fundamental problem is that it's a racket again. It's a scam. Capital, free to move. Labor, not free to move. That's visas, immigration, right? People cannot move to where the jobs are. This is a system rigged to take away from those who have labor and no capital, i.e. the 99% proverbially in the global, in the world, and give that money to the top 1%. It couldn't work any other way. You want free markets, you need both of them to be flexible. Right. If you have some who are open to get the chance of being flexible, others who are kept within their confines, the advantage is clear. So once again, it's a racket. It can't even theoretically raise all boats together and all those lovely sayings that we have. But you know, to go back to Taleb and this here and this kind of example of a right wing conservative kind of guy who writes very well about issues finance and beyond, really recommended Nassim Taleb, but and we'll put a link up. But he's assuming that we're trying to create a stable and perhaps more robust and benefiting all financial system. And that's another thing I think I'm repeating myself, but it's bear repeating. The problem is that decisions and rules are being made through lobbying with the 22,000% return rate by special interests, whose interests, sadly, are not stability, growth, jobs. There's this cannibalistic, the fiscal cliff. Well, the compromise that might come out is worse than going over the cliff. That's for sure. Not that over the cliff is necessarily great, but it's better than, I'm willing to say, than any compromise. The compromise is a racket. The compromise is an excuse to not cut all the pork that flows through the military procurement system. Obama will probably insist on some kind of raising of taxes for the very wealthy and not for the middle class, because he needs that politically, but will cut the poor to the bone, let them starve. Both Democrats and Republicans, certainly those in power, agree on that. So this compromise, this whole, be afraid of the cliff, we can't go over the cliff, is a complete sham, I think.
And as another note to listeners, this idea of, raising taxes on the wealthy, even if it happens, you know, there's the stated tax rate, and then there's the tax rate that people actually pay.
True.
So,
it's no bonanza. I mean, you're not getting everything out of that.
I can't believe I'm struggling to think of the name of the hedge fund manager, but it's the guy that runs Citadel Capital. I can't believe I don't remember his name. Anyways, he has an interesting little loophole. It's called the carried interest the carried interest loophole. Mm. So this guy, he makes, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1 billion a year.
I hate him already.
Okay,
I'm just joking.
What he'll
just class resentment.
What he'll do is, as long as he retains those earnings within his hedge fund, they're not taxable. Mm-hmm. Literally, it's not taxable. And what he'll do is he'll set that cash aside in the form of short-term government bonds in his hedge fund, and he'll borrow money from a bank against that as collateral at a very low interest rate, because he's borrowing cash against cash. And then he'll use the money he's borrowed from the bank in order to, you know, for whatever his living expenses if it's to buy a condo or, you know, buy a car or whatever, dinner.
I totally understand the scam.
His tax rate is effectively zero, because in the eyes of the IRS, he's a pauper. So, I mean, if you think that it's a concession that taxes are being raised on the wealthy, will some of the 1% pay more in taxes? Yes. Will some of the 0.1%, which is where you really start to get into the serious wealth distortions, because in the 1% you're dealing with doctors and lawyers, and you get in the 0.1% and you start
and veterinarians.
And veterinarians, yeah. That's a good point. But
expensive ones too.
1% nationally should be what?
A lot of the fact
$500,000 a year?
Is that, you know, if you raise the marginal tax rate, you know, if you allow it to revert to 39.6 or 42% or whatever it is, the truth is that the effective tax rate still might be in the, you know, 17-18%. And a lot of people that are in those income brackets, they have a choice as to when and how they take their income. You know, if they own stock, they can just say, well, I'm not going to sell any. I'll wait till the next administration. Maybe I get a lower tax rate. I mean,
that basic scam that you just finished mentioning is the same scam that my former employer used right after 9/11, where everybody just totally panicked and decided they were going to refinance all their loans and all that, and then at the same time ask for pay cuts and get rid of employees to hire people for minimum wage and stuff like that. But that's another topic. You know, let's.
Music. Yeah, we have to have music.
Yeah,
we have to have music
because
we shut up and we put some music on.
Well, okay.
We promise to ourselves.
Here we go. Something to talk about.
We'll be right back.
Hey folks, welcome back to Punkonomics, and you are listening to WPRK 91.5, the voice of Rollins College, the best in basement radio. And anyway, here we are. I know that some of you really enjoyed those tunes. I got a couple of requests for the Ramones the other night while I was playing drum and bass, which was kind of odd. But anyway, hopefully you got your request, so there you go. Anyway, back to our topics. When we went off the air to play some jams here, we got into a little conversation of how much is enough.
So I was actually recruited very kindly and treated very nicely by an institution in Florida. Can I mention the name of an academic institution that I participated in?
Of course,
in? Yeah,
of course,
right?
Why not?
That's
sure.
Not a plug. I'm not saying go study there. Weber International University. And it's a very right-wing place, again, in terms of, like I say right-wing, I think some people might think there's a whole bunch of people walking around
in uniforms,
stepping in brown shirts. No, but kind of, you know, certainly the economics, very libertarian, kind of, you know, very conservative. And they had like a Koch brothers that several times we mentioned and we'll do again because they are kind of about as close as you can get to the scum of the earth, the quintessential nasty rich people. But they were funding this kind of series of debate and they were looking for a token commie, basically. And I can assume any position, you know, given a proper... I didn't even know that I would get reasonably well paid, by the way. It's good to work for the man. But it was quite challenging to argue against profit. I have it on my YouTube channel, and it's their title was, Is Profit a Dirty Word? Already loaded right there. I mean, how do I step in to say yes, you know? I'm not... you know, completely out there, in fact, and have quite strong attachment to capitalism on multiple levels, though I criticize it where it deserves it. However, precisely the issue, so we had to deal with this issue of profits, you know, and we know that these profits can be critically important. Like Corey was saying, the manager will then reinvest some of the owner will reinvest some of those profits. That's, we call it capital accumulation, new machines, right? New technologies, research and development. Of course, today in America, we find that that's not where the profits are going. They're going to foreign luxury imports. You know, sure. We don't invest in America and we haven't for decades. And that's maybe the big failure of the right wing, the Reaganomics, these 30 years where everything has gone downhill, every measure. I think that's at the core of it. And Corey's going to pick up on a couple of things in a second. But philosophically speaking, arguing about that, so I'm bringing a little bit of that debate, it's, there's nothing wrong with getting filthy rich. First of all, how? Everything's in context.
Sure.
You know, things are not pure. It's certainly not in the real world and outside of the realms of the church. I'll leave that to your priests or whatever you do. In social science, it's all complex and it's all within context. So how are you making your money? You know, off of predating on poor people and destroying their finances like the vast majority of the financial industry over the past 15 years? Yeah, you're crooks. All of you. And right. You deserve to be punished instead of receiving government socialism, in the sense, do whatever you want. Oh, you lost all 30 years of our labor. Oh, have some more that we have today. You know, no accountability whatsoever. However, if you're not a member of the very top, then it's the law of the jungle for you. Capitalism actually requires, and early capitalists know this from the 19th century already, who built public schools, public health, all those things that are considered in America socialist. Hello? No, it's capitalist and basic capitalist institutions that were built, financed, advocated for by business people because they knew they need skilled labor, they want healthy labor, they want people to be able to purchase things in the economy. All of those things are good for business. So yeah, you can get very wealthy, no limits as far as my view goes, you know, in that sense. But off of the backs of who? Are you making it in a fair way, or are you hurting others in the process of making it? They have claims too. And the basic security network. The fact that if, as so many people, despite your hard work, despite everything, you fall, you do not fall to utter destitute. And this is peanuts. So this is, again, when we're talking, you know, we're spending trillions on wars that are, you know,
they're
basically
really
for the benefit. They are. They, again, the point, the weapon merchants, the 0.01% is making a killing, and they don't care that in the process, you know, GIs, innocent civilians around the world are murdered in large numbers. Once again, we're not looking for a stabilized world. You look at foreign policy today, whether it's Republican or Democrat, you don't see anybody trying to stabilize the Middle East. On the contrary, let's set it up on fire because there's profits in it.
You know, I'll give you, this is it. I've been wanting to share this statistic in a public setting for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be fascinated by this, all right? And this just goes to how important economics is, how important policy is, all right? Between 2001 mm-hmm. and 2000, it was either 10 or 11, mm-hmm. more children between the ages of 13 and 30, 30 is not really a child, I understand that, died on the south side of Chicago from gun-related violence. Then we lost soldiers in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. That's pretty remarkable. You're talking about the second largest city by population in the United States, mm-hmm. you know, one of the wealthiest countries on earth. And you have more gun-related deaths in that city than you do when you have soldiers in an actual battlefield setting where you have people actively trying to
yep.
kill you.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, it's off topic for the fiscal cliff, but if you ever think to yourself, oh, you know, this is just ivory tower, it's very academic, it doesn't affect me. I mean, this is actually really important because of, you know, those gun-related deaths that occur on the south side of Chicago, a very impoverished part of the city. You know.
Yeah, it talks about that. It speaks to the depth of poverty in America, which is deeper than any other, you know, rich country.
Right.
So, sure, we have other situation, but if you are at the bottom, you are lower than the beggars on the streets in Europe in terms of your standard of living and your opportunities. The crime is perfectly related to poverty levels and, very importantly, just as importantly, distribution of income. Our heroes, our leaders, our job creators, you know, they steal openly and get a bonus for it. What do you want the kid in the ghetto to think? There is no social institutions, no options. What? Oh, stay in school? What for? It's a failing school. You're just liable to get shot. Probably the death rate is higher in school. Don't stay in school. If you're a poor kid, really poor kid in America, the rational thing to do is to join a gang. These are the only people that'll
have your back. It's true. I mean, you join a gang because of, I mean, it's a form of protection. I mean, you either do it or you're probably going to be targeted.
It's just like many terrorist institutions around, you know, terrorist organizations, literally terrorist organizations that engage in terrorist activity. I'm not talking about people who have maybe cold terrorists without really deserving. They are often in cases in places like the Gaza Strip or in Somalia, different war-torn parts of the world, the only people who will give you formula for your baby. You know, where are you going to score antibiotics, or shall you watch your kid die? Right. These are the people that'll do it. There's nobody else, and therefore they get your support. So, yeah, there's a huge price to pay, and it's an ethical issue of having people like that and cutting. And right now, to go back, the fiscal cliff compromise is going to be about cutting food stamps, cutting food programs for the 20%. Let me repeat, 20%, 1 in 5 American children, and this is not up to 30, this is children, who are malnourished, you know? Right. So yeah, in America, we don't see the kind of, you know, bony hands and big tummies that we see in African starving people because they eat a lot of empty calories. But they are malnourished, and when the generation of kids who are preteen, teen today are gonna hit 40, experts tell us that we're looking at a massive death from diabetes, young people, yeah. Young onset diabetes. But so what are we gonna do about it?
And heart disease.
Oh, no, no. Well, the people who make decisions about our healthcare are going like this. Because all these dead children are money in the bank.
It's true. And that's, you know, if you're an economic student, one of the things you learn, one of the failings of GDP is that, you know, it's a great example. Sick people are good for the economy. Yeah. it's very perverse, right?
Mm-hmm. All the bads and the goods. And yeah, there's a bunch of, I mean, I teach it. A lot of people, anybody who's competent, I think, should teach in basic economics how to go about how you were saying that we never see a real economist on TV, pretty much. Yes. It's the same thing. Everybody's quoting to you the Dow Jones. A measure that not even financial people use for their statistics. They'd use the S&P 500 and stuff. The Dow Jones is completely arbitrary. So why are we quit? And people are following it as if it's like the priest at the top of the step pyramid or something, right? It's really a religious, ritualistic thing. Dow Jones went up. Yeah. Things good. It's like reading in the entrails of a dog before a battle in the Roman days. It's about scientifically equivalent. And GDP, you know, we went up 2 points, we went down 2 points. It's a very, very arbitrary number that misses a host of little things. But these do become, I think, kind of ritualistic symbols where people follow these numbers like a religious ceremony. So yeah, thinking about what's going on.
The other thing is that, you know, GDP is an aggregate measure. So, you know, if we were all to keep an equal stake, if you will, in the economy, it would be great if the economy grew, because then everybody grows. But, you know, the way things are set up now, you could have a lot of growth at the top and actually have living standards contract at the bottom and still end up with growth. And that's a problem with just looking at GDP. And it's another way of saying exactly what you just said.
And there are other measures. There are measures, but these aren't measures. And it's easy to look at one number. I mean, you can think there's a degree of fraud here where people look at it maybe in order to, and it's a major theme of our show, and I'm afraid it's a sign of our times, that we are always being played, that everything's a racket, that nothing is done for the stated purposes, and it's a political democratic failure. But it's also sometimes a little bit difficult, actually. The famous Noam Chomsky has a whole piece about that in Manufacturing Consent, about how to explain something, you know, in complicated truth of how complicated it is unpopular. What are you going to do? So, there's my segue for you. We have all of these, including most recently a lot from the president, talking about how, well, it's just like a family, right? When the family runs out of money, you can't spend anymore, you have to cut expenses and stuff. This makes me tear this hair out of my head, because the macroeconomy is nothing like
a family
financial system. But you just appeal to this kind of good Puritan kind of ideal of running the good family and not going into... But it doesn't work like that. It would be suicide if we ran... I mean, that'll really... It'll be like North Korea. You want a country that runs its macroeconomy and a sound family? North Korea is your example here. It's like the thing will go just implode
ironically
into
enough,
big crunch, you know, disappear. So, yeah, and for example, we have those multiplier things that you were talking about.
Well, first, you know, you go to concept marginal propensity for consumption. This goes back to how much, Jesse, this is how you led into this segment, is, all right, how much can a person actually make? You know, how much is too much? Well, not to address that directly, but the thing is that as you make more money, this is a pretty well-studied concept in economics, after a while, you don't spend a dollar for every dollar of income you have. You spend 80 cents, you spend 60 cents, 20 cents, 10 cents. And again, to the beginning of the show, that's an opportunity for somebody else's income. So as the wealth distribution gets skewed, and I'm surprised somebody hasn't done this. Perhaps I should look into doing it myself or just look to see if somebody has done it in the last 6 months or so. As the wealth distribution in this country has been skewed, right, and the income distribution, you've noticed that the velocity of money in this country is also tanked at the same time.
Right.
And the two are related because, again, the wealthier you are, chances are you're not going to spend all of your income, right? It's going to end up in a bank.
Sure.
Banks aren't lending right now, so it's not like that money finds its way back into the economy. And that's your leakage, right? That's your leakage from the economy. That's how the economy is contracting. So, I mean, when the federal government runs a deficit, right, that's an injection. You need those injections to balance out if you're just going to hold the line. Now, if you're going to grow, you need even more injections, right? So, this goes back to what you're saying. This is actually, for someone like Ben, I guess, who has a background, and I explained it pretty well, but if you don't have a background in economics, you probably don't.
Oh, in Carolina, in Chapel Hill, the teacher I started to teach under, my first teaching experience, he had a really nice trick to do it. He distributed the big 400 people auditorium, right? Art Benavi, to give the plug. I mean, the legal plug. So he would take a bunch of coins, like pennies, and give the first row in the big auditorium each 10 pennies each.
Right.
And he says, well, you have a marginal propensity to consume. So let's say you're going to generally consume 2/3 of that. So, how about 6 or 7 coins you're going to spend, and 3 you're going to put in the bank. So keep your 3. Turn around and give the 7, and that represents, you paid housing, you bought food, you bought whatever you want to buy. So now the person in the back has each one of, and we're standardizing it, right? They put aside 3, they have each 7. They take, 2 out of that in their savings and turn around and give 5 to the back. When you count all the economic activity that happened until the money kind of ran out to nothing at higher up the auditorium, the government, the professor in this case, that injected through spending, let's say building new highways, modernizing our ridiculous infrastructure, rotting bridges, ridiculous roads, even our slow internet, my geek complaint compared to some more other places, all of that stuff, power grid, right, things like this, you get much more than the original money. I mean, you put, let's say there were 100 kids, 10 kids in the first row, I can't do, 100's too difficult, right? Times 10, right? 10 times 10, 100 pennies he gave, right? But at the end, as you go through this process, way more than 100 pennies were actually injected into the economy, actually created real activity, real work. And maybe an important thing to remember, the great waste. The one big weakness of capitalism is unemployment, That's gone forever, unrecuperable. All that effort, all that creativity didn't happen this month. It's never coming again. It's lost forever. That's the real cost that a smart capitalist system, as in many cases, trying to fix.
To the multiplier thing, the right wing recently has viciously attacked the idea of there being a multiplier to government stimulus. The IMF about a month and a half ago, and the IMF is fairly conservative as far as things go, right? The IMF, they did a lot of advisory work to a lot of European countries in the last 3 years. They were the ones that were pushing for the austerity. The IMF actually released a working paper. So this is a proper paper, a statement of the IMF's position on economics. And it was basically a mea culpa saying we were wrong about this multiplier effect. The IMF, they stated, is kind of the inverse of a stimulus multiplier. It was an austerity multiplier. They were saying that for every dollar in government expenditure cuts, that there would only be 50 cents of an impact on real GDP. And what they said is, well, actually, for every dollar of government spending cuts, we saw $1.75 come out of real GDP.
We need to go. But the bottom line here is that precisely this is kind of the mechanics, if you will, coming from a respectable conservative institution, of the truth that this whole notion, the fiscal cliff again. Oh, we'll cut our deficit. We must cut. It's an argument about where to cut. No. It's a racket. In fact, those who are talking about cutting, we must cut Social Security, we must all that, they're wrong or the corrupt again. Because it'll not stimulate, it is for sure going to make not only the job situation get worse, the recession get worse, but the financial get worse. It'll make the deficit rise even worse, so that next time around they can come and really slash whatever's left of our capitalist system. The irony is that in the name of free market and capitalism, people are dismantling free market and capitalism. I'm not even questioning the premises. It's a racket. We need many shows about this, right? Oh. It's complicated stuff. Tune into our show. Get an econ degree for free.
Yeah, and for our audience out there,
without the homework.
If you have any questions for Dr. Ballard, for Currier, for me, we definitely have. I guess we can say that there is a Facebook page called Punkonomics, and of course, there's also a podcast which I just
you can
started
find
listening
on
to.
I'm so
tech backwards sometimes that, you know, when I find something as good as Punkonomics on a podcast, I just totally freak out, even though I was in the show for some reason.
I listen to podcasts a lot. That's how I find out. That's how we bring the fiscal cliff scam to you 3 weeks ahead of it even hitting the main part of the alternative press, which are talking about it all together. But, you know, you listen to us, we'll keep
absolutely
you ahead
of the curve. And if you just tune in, Punkonomics is here every Friday from 9 to 10. And I guess I should plug my show, too. I also have a music show, believe it or not. It's called The Organic Catnip Show. From 3 o'clock to 5 a.m. On Saturdays here on WPRK 91.5. And hopefully Paul McCartney is not listening to the show right now, because I'm totally butchering his Taxman song. Actually, it's one of my favorites because it really says how we feel, most of us feel today about the Taxman and everybody else.
I think it's consistently ranked as one of the, you know, the best right-wing songs, you know?
Yes, exactly. Anyway, I'm just going to go ahead and play it the right way, mainly because I know Paul McCartney hangs out here on the campus, and hopefully we can get him on the show to get his opinion. Hint?
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small? Thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, I'll tax the street. If you drive to see, I'll tax the
street. Economically viable. Hello? Yeah, I thank you for 7 years. Excuse me, I'll have your loan, Erica. Did they give you a loan?